It is case number A23-831, Thomas Patrick Ness versus the Commissioner of Public Safety. Counsel, as you know, each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal argument. Counsel for appellant, please introduce yourself and your client and then begin your argument.
Rich Kenley for the appellant, Thomas Ness, Your Honor. Morning to all counsel and the court. The issue we have today is whether or not the statute, as it was passed by our legislature, needs to be followed. The trial court held essentially that substantial compliance, which was argued by the state, in making a citizen aware of his options, and those are quotes from the trial court order, was adequate to uphold the revocation. I think it goes deeper than that issue. The officer in this case, off camera, said that he asked the appellant if he would take a blood or urine or which one he preferred, because the issue was whether or not he was going to have his clothes changed out. If it was going to be blood, they would change him into an orange jail uniform. And if he wanted to, I'm sorry, if blood would go to a hospital, he would leave his civilian clothes on to prevent embarrassment. And understandable, that was a very polite thing for the officer to do. All of that occurred off camera. What we do know on camera from the officer's body cam was after the warrant, the deputy did not direct either test. He said, he said that refusal was a crime. When he received no response from the appellant, he told the appellant that he was going to charge him with refusal. He did not state the language from the statute that requires him to say, will you take a blood test and wait for a response? And even under the facts, if he had done that and Mr. Ness had not responded, it would have been reasonable for the officer to take that as a refusal. He would have then had the
other. Why was it not reasonable for the officer to consider it a refusal under these circumstances? I mean, to be fair, your client was ignoring the officer, repeatedly ignoring the officer when the officer was asking questions or trying to direct. He was awake and non-responsive and non-compliant with the officer's directions. And why aren't we dealing with sort of an issue of futility here?
Well, what was allegedly stated by my client, that I'll give neither of those to you, that happened off camera. And the funny part is, when asked on direct exam at the trial, Deputy Brown was unsure of whether he had asked for a blood test or if he'd asked for neither. But that was recorded on his body camera. That's something he had access to. That was footage he took. But what happened off camera, which he could have recorded, in which the court relied upon as being adequate to make petitioner aware of his options of the blood or urine, that his memory was perfect with. And I had no way to challenge that because that was completely off camera. And again, the trial court relied on that. The whole purpose and why it's reasonable to your question, Your Honor, is that the statute and the legislature wants to not compel people, but encourage people to submit to testing. And of course, because of the aversion to either blood or urine, the legislature has decided that you have to give the options. Well, the statute, from my reading of it, my arguments, obviously, would say the officer needs to direct one test and get a response. If there is a refusal, if there's no refusal, fine, it's over. But if there is a refusal, then the other option needs to be given. And to allow the officer to follow his own procedure, I think that opens a door for a lot of officers. Essentially, if the trial court is upheld in this, there'll be a lot of personal procedures followed all over the state of Minnesota, Your Honor. The statute...
But what is an officer to do in a circumstance like this where the person to be tested is completely ignoring the officer? I'm going to give you a choice. You can take a urine or a blood test, ignoring him, not responding. What is an officer supposed to do? Just keep talking?
No, he doesn't have to keep talking, Your Honor, but he does have to follow the requirements of the statute. That's my whole argument. If you look
at the for what purpose? I mean, he's advised the person that they're required to take a test, that they have a warrant that's requiring them to take a test, tells them what the two options are, and they're still being, he's still ignoring the officer. So what's the purpose in having the officer continuing to comply with all of these requirements, as you say, when the subject of the testing is ignoring him?
Well, for the same reason the Nash court held that you have to use the proper language from the implied consent revocation. It all goes to eliminating confusion so that any directory or any language isn't confusing to the citizen. And the fact that the statute put that in there directly, that exact language, so that it would need to be read and should be required to be read to the citizen. And that is to avoid confusion. Once you get on a slippery slope where you don't need to read what the statute requires, we don't know what the officers are going to say. Hey, it could be blood, could be urine. The reason the statute and the legislature put it in there was so that if you did follow these exact requirements and you were ignored or told no, then it was clear that there was a refusal. And that's where a revocation and actually a criminal matter could also come of those.
That seems like in the Nash case, at least I'm not sure whether our court said in Nash the officer must follow the statute verbatim. I think what our court decided in Nash is that the statement made by the officer in that case was inadequate because it referred only to blood. It did not refer to the opportunity to take a urine test in lieu of a blood test, and therefore it was an inaccurate statement of Minnesota law and was misleading, but you know, based upon the facts of that case. In this case, it seems like the officer did refer to both. He said, I'm drafting a search warrant for blood or urine. Refusing to submit to that search warrant would be a crime. So it seems like the advisory given in this case is not a misstatement or not misleading for the same reasons as Nash. Is it an inaccurate statement of law for some other reason?
I can't say that it is, Your Honor, but the statute requires that you be directed and given the clear option of taking one test, and you must either submit or refuse. And at that point, you have the secondary. Neither of those were given. And I think that both are, well, one for sure. And then if a refusal, then the other should have been provided to Mr. Ness. You get into murky water when the officer can use whatever language he feels is right under his personal procedure. That's why the language was set forth in the statute.
You say he wasn't given a choice or he wasn't offered both. I mean, I think you are correct, perhaps, that they were not offered sequentially, but the officer did refer to blood or urine when talking about the warrant. And isn't that adequate?
I don't feel that it is, Your Honor. I don't know that the legislature thought it was either, or why would they have made it so explicit in the statute? I mean, in Nash, if an advisor that deviates from the exact wording is insufficient to sustain a revocation, if it's misleading or confusing, the whole purpose, I think, for the exact language in the statute is so that there is a standard that officers can rely upon where there won't be this issue before you or the trial courts. If the officer follows the statute and the conduct is the same, as I argued in my brief, that would have been adequate to uphold a revocation in this matter. However, Deputy Brown directed neither. He chose to follow his own procedure, and he did not direct one test or the other. I believe that is required by the statute for the purpose of giving us, again, that standard by which we know the conduct for a revocation or refusal should be held to.
This argument that the statute is mandatory and not directory, which is, I think, what you're saying right now, was that raised below? And if so, can you point us to where in the transcript or the record that issue was raised and addressed below?
I'm fairly certain I put it in my trial brief, Your Honor. I'd have to pull that out.
Okay. But, thank you.
But I'm certain I raised it in my trial brief, Your Honor. Mr. Rahman, I'm sure, can tell me if I'm wrong about that when he gets his few minutes or his 10, 15 minutes. But I did argue the same thing in my appellate brief as my trial brief, obviously. But without the exact statute, the state relies upon this statute to revoke your driver's license. That's a property interest. But more importantly, the revocation and the conduct of this officer and what happened can be relied upon to put a man in prison, to put anybody in prison. This revocation, if it stands, will count towards any potential future revocations, which have become a deprivation of liberty, as I'm sure you're all aware. Because of that, and because obviously just because Mr. Ness can't, he lost his driving privileges, and it's a property right. Because of both of those, the state should be held to the standard set forth in the statute. The statute is used to take away the rights of a citizen. It's used to put people in jail or prison. And if the citizen needs to adhere to that statute, why is the state allowed to follow it loosely? I don't believe that's the way the legislature meant it. And I don't believe that it's here that follows the intent.
Well, counsel, what would happen if we didn't have this statute?
Well, then I think the officers could do pretty much what they wanted, Your Honor. Right. They'd follow whatever statute we did have.
They'd have a search warrant. They could take him wherever they want. And if he resisted, he'd be charged maybe with another crime. The whole point of this statute is to provide a mechanism so you don't have these disorderly conducts or assaultive or obstructive behavior in response to a search warrant. And it doesn't carry the same kind of concerns that the implied consent law does, where you don't have a search warrant, where you're trying to use the force, basically, of the applied consent advisory to encourage someone to provide a sample. Wouldn't you agree?
I do agree with that, Your Honor. I mean, the whole purpose was so we don't have to hold people down and try and shove a needle in their arm. That makes sense to me, and I think it makes sense to the legislature. But if we're going to use the sanctions of the state, both with the revocation and deprivation of liberty, and there is a statute, which is what we have, I'm asking that it be followed, that the language in it be followed, at least both options should have been clearly spelled out. And there should have been, and that's the other part of the statute. You have to refuse one, the blood, for instance. You have to refuse that. And no action can be taken against you unless they then offer you the urine. And there was legislative intent behind that, because some people are squeamish about one or the other. If you're squeamish about both, well, you're out of luck in Minnesota. But the way this was done, the officer didn't make that clear enough. He didn't follow the statute, which, again, is the standard that I feel must be used. Will you submit to a blood test? If you say no, if you swear at the officer, or you just ignore him, that can be reasonably taken as a refusal. Then you offer the alternative and you get the response, whatever that may be. At that point, and only at that point, I believe under statute, is a refusal charge and a revocation called for. I'm good with if you guys don't have any further questions.
It appears there are no further questions. Thank you, Mr. Kenley. Counsel for respondent, you please identify yourself and your client, and then you may begin your argument.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Karthik Rahman, and I represent the respondent in this matter, Commissioner of Public Safety. I'd like to start by touching on some of the discussion that this panel had with my opposing counsel. The first thing I'd like to discuss, as Judge Johnson noted, Nash doesn't require any verbatim language when an officer gives an advisory under subdivision one of this statute. What Nash does do is incorporate the McCormick framework of analysis. And what McCormick says is basically that an advisory under an advisory must be must not be misleading, confusing, or an inaccurate statement of law. And further, McCormick made clear that the context of the comments made during the advisory is important. In McCormick, that meant that even though the breath test, the breath portion of a breath test wasn't mentioned, because breath was the only type of test mentioned in the entirety of the process, it was clear that the driver should have known that the breath test is what was being discussed. And so with that type of reasoning, the discussion that the deputy had prior to obtaining the warrant is important context for what the deputy said after obtaining the warrant. I would argue that what the deputy said after obtaining the warrant in itself is sufficient for subdivision one. To reiterate what Judge Johnson had said, the deputy mentioned, as I said earlier, I was obtaining a search warrant for your blood or urine. I have that warrant in my hand. Refusal of this warrant is a crime. And in those three statements, he basically said all the words that subdivision one has in it. So, and as Mr. Kenley appeared to acknowledge on during his discussion, it's not a misstatement of law, and it's a clear statement of law. So in terms of subdivision one, I believe that the deputy was compliant with this part of the statute. With regard to subdivision two,
I mean, I think Mr. Kenley's argument is that the statute is designed to promote uniformity and to direct, not require officers to follow a particularized procedure in order to result in a refusal. And that wasn't followed here. Do you want to address that?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. So with regard to appellant's argument that there's a specific procedure that must be followed in the statute, I believe that that's a misreading of the statute. When reading subdivision two of the statute, which is where appellant is drawing this argument, the line that he is directing us to is contextualizing the previous two or three lines. The statute first says that the deputy must direct what's provided for in the warrant, whether it be blood or urine or both. And then it goes on to say the deputy may direct one test over the other. So if the warrant provides for a blood or a urine test, the deputy, the officer may say, will you give a blood test at first? And then if that first test is refused, then the state can only prosecute the driver for refusal if the officer then provides the alternative test as an option, and then the driver refuses that alternative test. This court has said in many cases that providing both options at the same time is sufficient to direct both the blood and urine test under the warrant. Mr. Kenley has not been able to provide this court with any authority from this court or from the legislature that says that a specific direction of blood and then a specific direction of urine is required in order to meet the requirements of the statute. The deputy in this matter did mention prior to the obtaining the warrant that he was going to get a warrant for blood or urine, asked what the appellant's preference would be. The appellant specifically stated, I'm not going to give either of those to you. Which indicates first that he knew that there were two options, and second indicates that he did not intend to comply with the testing procedure. And then after he was given the warning of that of the consequences of refusal, he was wide awake and aware of the deputy, but made no attempt to change his position and was completely silent as the deputy asked if he was refusing to test pursuant to the warrant. I think this is a pretty clear case of refusal, given the conduct of the appellant.
Does the determination of refusal hinge on sort of reading in a futility argument under these kinds of circumstances, where you've got a subject of testing who is completely non-responsive and refuses to engage, declines chooses not to engage with the officer when the officer is providing these choices to the subject of the testing?
I think that's certainly an avenue for refusal. Refusal by conduct is a whole body of case law that this court has ruled on in various contexts.
Yeah, I mean, my question's a little bit different, and that is it would be futile for the officer to comply with all of the requirements that Mr. Kenley is arguing are mandatory under the statute. Is there some basis to arrive at that conclusion?
I think there's a common sense basis to arrive at that conclusion. I'm not aware. I mean, I do know that there is at least one case that says that a deputy can't or a peace officer can't be penalized for not moving forward with an implied consent advisory if that inability to move forward was based on the driver's conduct. I don't know if that has been held in the context of statute 171.177. Based on case law from the predecessor statute as well as common sense, it doesn't strike me as any different saying, are you refusing to test pursuant to this warrant versus will you provide a blood test and will you provide a urine test when appellant made no indication of answering any of the deputy's questions.
Now, counsel, do you know, as a standard procedure, what are officers trained to do? Are they trained to offer the blood test first and the urine second, or the other way around? Or does it depend on the geographical location of the incident? Or you know, it seems like it used to be they always wanted urine because it was better for testing for illegal substances than blood in many ways.
I don't know. I don't think there's any standard training across law enforcement agencies. There may be different training from agency to agency. In my experience, the officers generally ask for a blood test first, and then only go for a urine test if that's impossible, or if a driver refuses to provide a blood test first.
Could you remind me of some of the history of the implied consent statute? I don't have all of the materials in front of me, but am I correct in recalling that there was a time in the past where in chapter 169 or 169A, there was a paragraph in the statute that said something to the effect of the officer shall say this? In other words, you know, did the implied consent statute have a more specific statutorily required advisory in the past? Because I don't see that type of advisory in 171.177. Can you kind of educate me about that background a little bit, please?
Yes, Your Honor. So I know for sure that there is a specific advisory that is required in the breath test context at this point. At one point prior to the U.S. Supreme Court's Birchfield decision, both breath test as well as blood and urine tests were all governed by the same statute, Minnesota statute section 169.123. And I believe that what is now called the breath test advisory was at that point an implied consent advisory. I know that advisory was required for breath tests even at that point. I can't say without doing some further research as to whether that advisory was required for blood and urine tests as well. At that point, prior to Birchfield, the blood and urine tests did not require a search warrant. So I'm not sure how the inclusion of a warrant changes that analysis as well. But there would have been a time when the statute that governed all three types of tests would have had specific language that needed to be said, at least in certain contexts.
Okay, so am I correct in recalling that the breath test advisory has basically a statute that, you know, prints or quotes specific language that should be read verbatim according to that statute?
There is specific language that's required with the breath test. I believe it's been ruled that minor deviations from the breath test language are still not enough to render an advisory deficient. That's what McCormick was talking about when the court, this court viewed that that issue of what happens when you say test without the word breath in it. But aside from those minor deviations, I believe that there's a general advisory that must be given in the breath test context.
And would you agree with me that this statute that we're looking at today is different?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that the statute, given what Subdivision 1 says, requires that, and what this court, how this court has analyzed in the past, it requires that driver know the consequences of refusal before they can refuse. So they must be aware that that there might be criminal consequences to not providing a test sample. Beyond that, there's no specific language that the case law or the statute mandates when giving the advisory or when administering the blood or urine test.
Counsel, couldn't an officer just ask a person that's been stopped for a driving while impaired, say, a charge, whether they'll provide a breath sample without invoking implied consent?
So there are two types of breath tests. One is a preliminary breath test. That's a roadside test that the officer needs reasonable articulable suspicion in order to ask someone to provide. The evidentiary breath test requires probable cause and an invocation of implied consent language before that can be requested. In the blood or urine context, as in this case, obviously a warrant is required before you can request a blood or urine sample from a driver.
Is that a change in the law yet then? Because used to be, especially with State Patrol, they just ask fellows if, you want to give me a breath test? And if you said yes, they took them down to the station and gave a breath test. And then if they refuse, they wouldn't be able to go through the implied consent revocation of their license. But if they agreed to it, it was a voluntary test and it came in as evidence. The results of it did.
I'm not sure if that's a change in the law. That's my understanding of how the law is now. I'm not sure if the law was different earlier in terms of when you could ask for a breath test or not. So to summarize, there is a certain language that must be imparted, or the deputy must inform the appellant of certain information prior to requesting a sample, or prior to deeming someone as having refused the sample. The deputy imparted that information pursuant to Subdivision 1 in this matter, and throughout the testing process, the appellant showed an intent to refuse. And in order to determine a refusal, we look at a driver's intent as opposed to the deputy's actions. Further, with Subdivision 2, there is no particular procedure that is mandated. Appellant's theory, it does not comport with a plain reading of the statute or with any case law that I have read. I'm happy to answer any further questions Your Honors have. Otherwise, I yield the rest of my time, and I ask that this court affirm the district court's decision.
Thank you, Mr. Rahman. Mr. Kenley, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Here, the deputy deemed refusal of both the blood and the urine. He did so without directing either test, and the plain reading of the statute says that an officer must direct a test. I think I cited the definition of direct, which means a command from authority, in my brief. The statute sets out what must be said. Referring back to Nash at page 711, they say that under the case law and advisory, that deviates from the exact wording set forth in the statute, is insufficient to sustain the revocation of the driving privileges if it is an inaccurate statement or confusing. The whole purpose of the statute saying one must be directed, and if refusal, then the other must be directed, that is the bar set by the legislature so that we know where that's the standard that needs to be followed. I mean, why else would the legislature have made it so explicit? Further, Nash.
So Mr. Kelly, okay, maybe I'm going where you're going next, but it seems to me the ultimate question is whether the advisory that was given was an inaccurate statement of law or was misleading or confusing in context. Was it so? And if so, why?
Well, it didn't comply with the statute. You've got somebody who...
Well, was it an inaccurate statement of law in the sense that it inaccurately described your client's rights and the consequences of a refusal?
I think it is, in as much as the officer just took it as a refusal for both types of the test. Now, the warrant authorized both types of the test, but rather than direct one test or the other, the officer chose to do neither and to just hit my client with a refusal. The whole purpose, as you have a right to a choice of those two tests, you have to refuse one before the other one's offered, and nothing can be done against a citizen who has not been offered both. I think that the way the deputy did it would have certainly have confused Mr. Ness, or could have possibly confused him, in the fact that the statute says, will you take a breath test? Or I'm sorry, will you take a blood test? And if there's a refusal to that, then the urine is offered. Nash cites Tyler.
Is that, Counselor, what the statute actually says? Because doesn't it say may rather than must? I know you could probably read it as broader than may usually is, but it does say the officer may direct whether the test is a blood or urine. It doesn't say must. It just says that he has to offer both.
Well, he has to offer one and then the other, Your Honor. I think that's pretty clear in the statute. I think the may portion of that means the officer may direct blood or urine in his discretion. But I don't think that he's or an officer is free to not offer both if one is refused. When Nash cited the Tyler v. CPS, they cited him for the requirement that compliance with the procedures of the implied consent law is a prerequisite to revocation under that law. Now, this isn't the implied consent law. This is 177. However, 177.171. However, the Nash court used those same standards of compliance with the statute to make their finding that the revocation was improper in Nash. If there's a non-response, as happened here, both options should be given. Where's the harm for requiring the officer to actually follow the statute and direct the blood test? If he gets a no or no response, direct the other. The state would allow an officer to direct neither test, which I think is in violation of the statute. I mean, the officers are given a sheet. I've read them. I've seen them. They come in my discovery where they literally read the sections of the statute, at least in Cass County, Minnesota. The statute requires a minimum for revocation. Refusal of both is not provided. Basically, the appellant has to refuse one, and then the other must be offered. That's in the statute. That didn't happen here, and that's the reason I think that this needs to be rescinded, Your Honors. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kenley, for your rebuttal argument. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted, and the court will issue its opinion within 90 days.